Well, one of the things that comes up over and over is what is the difference between monk's practice and lay practice? What is the difference between fully ordained people and beginners? What is enlightenment? And if you get it, does that make you an achiever? That you've gotten somewhere? There's so many mixed messages about what we do. So many complicated ways that the human mind takes simple experience, creates an idea from the experience, and then from that idea creates whole packages of layers and layers of complicated arrangements. And my challenge has always been how to cut through all those layers and layers of arrangement and get back to the original experience. And perhaps the original idea that helps cultivate that experience without getting caught by all the commotion that can be built up around something so simple as our practice. I've just read a little history of Dogen Zenji, and I'm reading the book that Okamura wrote about the Genjo Koan, which I recommend to everybody. It's such a clear and interesting book. And both of those places, they talked about how in Dogen's time, Zen was very, very elaborate. It really wasn't Zen, it was Tendai, which was one of the many branches of Buddhist practice in Japan. And it was extremely hierarchical and extremely idealistic, had all these very fancy ways of arranging things for people. And their teaching was that all beings have Buddha nature. Buddha nature is in everything. And then so Dogen asked his teachers, why do we practice? Why do we have to practice if it's already that way? And nobody really knew the answer. They said, because we've always done it this way. This is what Buddha wanted. So he went to Japan and practiced with a lot of different teachers at many different temples. And finally asked the teacher he discovered, who told him that we don't make distinctions like that. That Buddha practices. That's what practice is being Buddha. So you don't have to go someplace or do something special. You just practice. So Dogen came back with the teaching that all beings are Buddha nature. Not that all beings have Buddha nature. It's not like something tucked into us somewhere. It's just that the whole kit and caboodle is Buddha itself as a universal functioning of life. So he ended up teaching over and over that practice and enlightenment are one thing. We don't have to go somewhere to get enlightened. We practice to embody and to express Buddha nature. We can't just so easily on our own hook embody Buddha in a way that we would recognize for ourselves. But we don't have to. It isn't that we polish up our life and then go around with a serene smile and bless everyone. That isn't what our Buddha nature is. When we're most intimate with ourselves, when we're most honest with ourselves, when we peel back all the layers of expectations that we have, ideas that have been given to us about what a good person or a bad person we are, we're full of all of those labels that have been put on us and by which we often live. But there's what is called in Zen an original person. An original person that is living us. And that one isn't so muddied up with all the many ideas about who we are and how we are and what we're supposed to be. It's the original person who sits zazen. So Dogen says, every day we wake up and return to awakening. It's like that koan that I told at the end of Sesshin this time, last month, about the practicer who gets up and says to herself her name, Mary? And then she answers herself, yes. And she says to herself, are you awake? And she says, yes. And she says to herself, then don't be fooled by anything. And starts her day. It's that kind of original person, being awake, being willing to be awake. Sometimes it sounds lovely, awakening. Our practice is about awakening. But we awaken to really tough problems. We awaken to a lot of suffering and difficulties. Awakening is not some glorious accomplishment. It's more like a job. Except it's in terms of our practice, in terms of our zazen practice, which turns what can be excruciating into opportunity. The way Buddha turned Mara's hosts of challenges into opportunities to really look, really see what it is. What the mind is, what the mind does with what happens. We have the happening, and then we have what we do with it. And if you notice, we're defining every single thing that happens. Oh, this was a good thing. That wasn't so good. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. Did you see what he did? We're putting a constant kind of judgment on everything that we see. And it's all aimed back at making ourselves more coherent and more okay if we can. Or at least to confirm who we think we are. And curiously, we don't need to do this. We really don't need to do it. We can stop it where the happening is. And that's where the practice is. Before we begin to spin it into something else. Excuse me. One old teacher said about Dogen, in the case of Dogen Zenji, his religious experience is not attaining some sudden and special psychological satori experience. Dogen never talked about such an experience in Shobo Genzo. In his teachings, realization is a deep awareness of the fact that the existence of the self is not a personal possession of the self. In his teachings, realization is a deep awareness of the fact that the existence of the self is not a personal possession of the self. So Dogen had TB, and he was sick off and on through much of his life. His parents died of TB. And when he was in his early 50s, he got very sick and decided he'd better go back to Kyoto and get some help. And just before he left, he added one more thing to a little book that he was planning to write, which he called Eight Means to Enlightenment. And it was the last thing he ever wrote. It never got finished. But the Eight Means to Enlightenment sounds like, oh boy, now we know what boat to get on or what train to take, and it'll take us right there. But his means to enlightenment are freedom from greed, satisfaction, which he defines as being fully quenched by what's given, be fully quenched. You know, your thirst is quenched, to be having it completely enough by whatever is given. To enjoy serenity by living without attachment. To practice diligence, striving to be good. Preserve awareness of Dharma, of the truth. Practice samadhi, zazen, every day. Practice wisdom by engaging in self-observation. Very important. It's not an idea. It's looking at what happens, what's here, who's here. And of course, practicing wisdom means practicing compassion, because without compassion, wisdom doesn't function. And the last is refrain from frivolous speech. It's all so ordinary. Refrain from frivolous speech and earnestly seek to understand the true nature of all things. He said, study these, our merit will increase, and finally we will realize supreme enlightenment. just don't gossip and don't be greedy. I think this is so helpful. If it's not taken as a kind of it's not like a Sunday school teacher saying you've got to be good, but saying this is the path to true enlightenment. This is the path to Buddha nature itself. In your life, in my life, as you get up in the morning and brush your teeth, as I make my coffee and feed the birds, everything we do is what it is. Everything we are is what we're looking for. We can't believe it if we don't have a sitting practice. It isn't true until it's embodied and embraced. And it isn't a final thing, it's an always and ever endeavor. It always goes on. So sometimes I think enlightenment is held up to us as a kind of carrot, you know, just come on, you can sit through the pain because you're going to get something really nice at the end. But if you sit long enough, you begin to realize that there's no carrot. There's just this. And that this is more than enough. So that's my talk. Are there questions? Julie?
What are your thoughts about emotion? Strong emotions, such as fear, anger, strong emotions?
Well, they're called greed, anger, and ignorance are called the three poisons. And they're the ones that we suffer and suffer and suffer with. And they're the reason that often, most often, that we come to practice, because they're so hard to deal with. And they also are our gift, because they wake us up to the problem of being human. How can we be this and deal with so much anger? With so much despair, with so much of everything that we go through, including our ignorance, where we just walk around like this and try not to see anything at all. All of which creates a lot of suffering for us. So, they're what we are always practicing with. And the more we're able to recognize ourselves through those things, through our emotions, the less personal they feel. They're like weather. It comes up. You get a rush of greed when you walk by a bakery window and see the chocolate eclairs in there. Oh! No, you didn't make yourself do that. You just did. Anger can be like that too, when you're walking along and you're just fine, or you're driving along and you're just fine, and suddenly somebody does something, and suddenly this rush of anger just comes. So we have to see it's in us, these things. And even though we try terribly, terribly hard to be good and often just pretend that we don't feel what we feel, it just creates a shell with a lot of stuff going on underneath the shell that's extremely uncomfortable. It's much more honest to acknowledge what we feel. Acknowledge when we're messed up, how messed up we are. and try our best. When we take the precepts, before we take the precepts, we do a little four-line acknowledgement. It says, all my ancient wrong actions arising from beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance based on mind, speech, and body, altogether I now fully avow. You don't say, I'm not going to do it anymore. You say, this is how it is with me. And then you take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And Buddha as the teacher of you, in you, the Dharma as the truth in you, and the Sangha as the whole world as you express it in your life. So that you're not alone. And then you take the precepts, and the precepts are acknowledging that, in particular, all the things that we tend to do. We tend to kill, take what's not given, tell lies, steal, blitz our mind in some way or another, commit sexual misconduct, praise ourselves and blame others, etc. And the precepts, if we understand them correctly, are what stop us when we do something so that we can recognize what we're doing when we do it. It can't make us stop because we have to eat the carrot that we've killed. But we, once we acknowledge that we have killed, we can appreciate the carrot, appreciate our life, and widen our experience of how things are in our world with gratitude and kindness. And the same with taking what's not given, which is how they talk about stealing. You know, you take a pencil off of somebody else's desk. In Buddhism, that's stealing. And of course we all do it. But if we recognize that we've done it, then we can do something about it. Instead of just sort of blindly trying to pretend that we're a whole lot better than we are. We're not so much better than we are. We're not so big as we think we are. And our practice is about bringing us down to our own regular size, the size we are, the way we are. Because only from here, only from this place, your own place, your own seat, does Buddha live, Buddha nature live. That makes sense? Donna Lynn?
What book did you find the eight steps or keys to enlightenment?
Oh, in a lot of places. It's at the end of Shobo Genzo. It's usually put at the end of Shobo Genzo in all the translations. Yeah.
It certainly parallels the precepts.
Yes. Yeah, I think he was just reprising the whole thing.
Rilke, he did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The poet, he did something. I don't know, you may just listen, you know, how to be a good person. Funny,
because
it's also
everyday-ish. Yes. Well, every day is where it's at. And even if we went to a monastery and became monks, it would still be everyday-ish. We would wear funny clothes, you know. and life would be less interesting in a way, because it would be more more the same day after day, but it would still be every day. And we would have to work in the kitchen, and we wouldn't like the person working next to us, even though they were a monk too. I mean, they're all the dynamics of human intercourse and relationship that happen in every situation that humans get together in, however exalted they try to be. So best way is to be honest. Honest and kind, as the Dalai Lama says. Which is easier said than done. Which is why waking up in the morning, it's really, it helps to just make a point of checking, you know, am I awake? Annabelle, did you wake up this morning? Maybe, maybe not.
I have a question, and it relates back to the emotion thing. And you may have answered this, but I missed it if you did. So I remember at Sashin, once you were speaking of, like, I think anger maybe, and you said that we should realize it's a distortion or something like that. But I think in my own head, I had started to think about strong emotions, maybe sort of like, you know, I mentioned, like, when it's cold, be cold Buddha, be hot Buddha. Or maybe I was starting to think, when you're angry, just be angry Buddha. Yeah. Not necessarily act on it.
Yes.
Except that that's what I am at this moment.
Yes.
So, but to call it a distortion makes it sound like it's not part of the Buddha self, the anger. And also even calling it the three poisons, which is a big part of
Yes.
So where does that sort out?
Good question. Very good question. Of course, angry Buddha. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Crying Buddha. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what I was referring to, I think, was the Bodhidharma precepts, mm-hmm. in which he said about anger, that anger is supposing that there's somebody over there and somebody here, mm-hmm. that there's a self and another, and a big chasm between, and that somehow that's a huge misunderstanding. In the truth of no self, no other, he talks about no being angry. Mm-hmm. That it's just a completely ignorant thing to be, because it's not true. There isn't anybody over there. Mm-hmm. That's me too. And so all of the precepts are, and all of those things that we're talking about, all of the emotions, all point back to this. Me, 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 me. It's all about me. You know, I'm angry at you because you did this thing to me. And it becomes extremely narrow. The whole picture gets lost in it. And we're not able to meet the situation in a calm enough mind to be able to understand enough to see how we belong together. It's sort of like the Israelis and Palestinians, you know, they get close and then they, bam, something happens, and then they're not seeing each other anymore. They're just mad. And then slowly, slowly, I think we do this all the time. And the only way to get see through all of that is to have a big enough picture that we can see that the other is ourself.
That was me thinking out loud.
in the big picture, that's the truth of it. And we tend to make the separation because the other is scary to us. We're afraid of each other. We're afraid of everything, in a way. We're animals, and we're very cautious animals. So that's built in. There's a whole system in our brain that just keeps us going as animals. But we also have a human brain that is able to see a much larger picture and can, if it finds the way to inner peace and a sort of, inner peace is enough. If it's quiet enough in here, we begin to hear everything speaking, hear everything singing, begin to realize that everything we experience is what's happening. That what we call me is all of it. Or I'm not, all of it is, like looking in a precious mirror in which you see, how does it go? Your own reflection. You're not what it is, it's what you are. So it means our idea about me, even though it's very necessary, we have to dress me and pass tests and drive a car and all of those things, but it's only a small part of everything that's going on. It's also my life. And which, in the Tibetans they say everyone we meet was once our mother. That's the way they cast it, which always turns out to be problematic in America because so many people had problems with their mothers. But in Tibet, mother is the highest of the high. So if you can imagine that everyone you meet was someone precious to you at another time, it begins to express what this is about self and other. Of course, the other is different, but there's something there that connects us, even strangers. It's hard to talk about.
Trying to see what's kind of what we really are and what you are, I find that as I'm sitting, my mind will be going literally blah, 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 blah. I'm just totally incoherent, gibberish. I don't know what the question is. sometimes it's very powerful. I mean, strong. It just overwhelms everything.
Yes. Yes. You're just squirting thoughts. And the mind gets bored sitting. So the first day or so of sitting is often like that. It's just blah, blah, blah all day long. Because the mind just wants to do something and we're not running around and deciding things. So it just makes up its own kind of buzz. Doesn't mean anything at all. But there's still something there that's breathing, that's heart is beating, and whose whole circulation systems are all happening. The sounds are coming in and being not only worked on here, I mean, you can think about sounds, but the sounds are coming all the way through your whole body. And you're being, you're feeling your life down here in your belly, where there's a whole other bundle of nerves, like another brain almost, that's factoring in all the things that are happening. So that you are living, being as you sit, with a sort of anxious brain, because a bored brain is trying to stir you up and get you to do something more interesting. It's a funny kind of place to be, and if you sit long enough, then the brain gets tired of it. It has a lot of tricks. It can start playing music. You can get, you know, every song you ever heard will start running in your mind. Or it will create itches. You think, I have to scratch, I just have to move. It will create pictures on the wall, funny faces and little animals, and all kinds of weird things show up on the wall that is just being projected out there because it wants to look at something. So you kind of pat it on the head and say, it's okay, don't worry. And just come back to being down here. Keeping your mind in your hands or in your belly helps a lot because it keeps you more in your body as your brain just keeps spinning. And it doesn't help to get mad at it or try to make it stop because that just makes it worse. Then there's you and it, and you're, you know, it doesn't work. So just be with it and say, oh, here I am with my brain spinning away, but there's the sound of the traffic and it's cooling off, and, you know, your feet are connected and everything is as it is, and breathing in and breathing out. And after a while, the body begins to settle and then the mind settles. And then it becomes a pleasure, breathing in and breathing out and just being this body, this perfectly okay body, just as it is in the world. A piece of the earth, a piece of the air. But it takes some determination to and to learn what the brain does and to accept it as part of its function. Because sometimes when it thinks it's very helpful, and it might throw up a useful idea in the course of all of that too, but you don't have to write it down. You know, if it's really important, you'll remember it. Well, shall we sit? That's it. Thank you.